Please open your Bible to Proverbs chapter 10. That's where we'll start today. Proverbs 10. And I want to look at verse 12 with you, which says that hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions. Probably everybody knows that the book of Proverbs is meant to be taken as general statements rather than absolutes that will always do what they say they'll do. A good example of that would be the one that says that if you train up a child in the way he should go when he's older, he will not depart from it. There are many people who have tried to do that with your children, and yet they still have some children that do not follow God's will. So when we look at this text in Proverbs 10 and verse 12, we need to figure out what exactly the author means, because probably all of us are already thinking of some objections about this. Love covers all transgressions. Clearly that doesn't mean that if you know somebody is living in sin, that you're just going to cover it up in the sense of protecting it so that that person can keep living that way. That's not what God did with the father of the man who wrote this. This was penned by Solomon, a man who was conceived between the union of David and Bathsheba. And when David committed that sin, God loved David enough to send the prophet Nathan to go and publicly expose his sinfulness so that he would be rescued from it. I think looking at this, we already know too, that this doesn't mean that you don't seek to address sin and to correct it, even if it's a different circumstance. Yes, God may do that by sending a prophet, but he also expects his own people to do that. When you look in the New Testament, you see people that sometimes live in open, sin-filled lives, like the fornicator at Corinth. And when Paul wrote to the brethren there, he told them the same thing that God did with David when he sent Nathan. That's what you need to do with this person. You need to confront this person about it and act on it and try to rescue that person from his sin. When you read Proverbs 10 and verse 12, it also doesn't mean that sometimes when you commit sin that there won't be lasting consequences. David was forgiven by God, but God never trusted him after he approached him about his sin with Bathsheba. And he told him, you're going to remember what you've done until the day you die because of the consequences that will now befall you. So if this proverb that says love covers all transgressions doesn't mean any of those things, what does it mean? You may notice too when you look at it that these are two opposite statements. And any time in Jewish poetry like this where you have two opposite thoughts colliding against each other, that's done to help the reader make sense of what is being said in the proverb. There's a really good example of this in another place in the text. So what I'm going to do is put a marker here in Proverbs 10. I'm going to ask you to do the same thing and then go with me to chapter 27. And we can demonstrate what I'm talking about. In Proverbs 27 and verse 6, there is a proverb that Solomon wrote that said that faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Now those are two opposite thoughts that collide with each other here. And if you contrast them with one another, then you can really get to the heart of what he's saying. Obviously, he's not saying that in order to be a good friend, you're just going to go around hurting people. But if you are hurting somebody because you are that person's friend, and if you're on the receiving end of that hurt, he said that these wounds are faithful. In other words, they're trustworthy. A friend is going to tell you what you need to hear, even if you don't want to hear it. Like Jesus when he told Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." An enemy, on the other hand, is deceitful. He might kiss you, he might flatter you, but he's doing it for personal advantage. Like Judas, when he identified his master with a kiss in front of the Lord's enemies. This, by the way, when you read Proverbs 27 and verse 6, it might tell you something too about the kind of people that you want to keep in your most intimate circles. Do you want people who are never going to tell you what you need to hear? Do you want people around you all the time who are only going to tell you the things that they think you want to hear? Because if you want to live righteously, you're going to need people in your life who are willing to hurt you when it's necessary and tell you what you need to hear. So then, let's go back to Proverbs 10 and verse 12. We've got this contrast between love and hate and the character of each. That helps us understand exactly what he means by hatred stirring up strife. We might think that that is just the way of hatred generally. It just goes around looking to cause problems. And that may be true, but there is a very specific problem that this proverb has in mind. If love covers all transgressions, the opposite of that is stirring up strife over somebody's sins. The hatred in this text goes around and looks for a fight to be had because of what someone else has done that he should not have done. Maybe that person has sinned against you. Maybe that person has sinned against somebody else. But if I'm acting on hatred, then I'm going to look for a cause for trouble because of the sins committed by this other person. Hatred stirs up strife in that sense. Love just does the opposite. It covers these transgressions. What does that mean? Look over in Psalm 32, this time from a psalm that was written by David, believed to have been written after he was confronted with his sin with Bathsheba and repented of it. Psalm 32 and verse 1. He says in the first line of this psalm, "How blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven." And then I think he just restates that same idea with different words in the very next line. He says, "whose sin is covered." There's our word. And in this text, when you read it here, you see that when Jews talked about covering something, specifically their sins, it was the idea of forgetting the sin and forgetting it. Forgiving and forgetting it. So then back in Proverbs 10 and verse 12, when Solomon said that hatred stirs up strife, if I understand him, and he says that love covers all transgressions, he means that sin was forgotten in the sense that it wasn't dredged up over and over out of bitterness or spite, simply looking to hurt somebody or maybe to gain a personal advantage, perhaps by making this person who has sinned look bad in the eyes of other people. It wasn't done to hurt someone's reputation or standing with others. Now, does that mean that you can never bring up somebody's past sins? It does not. Paul was a man who confronted Peter and Barnabas about their hypocrisy. And we only know that he did that because he wrote about it to somebody else. He mentioned it in Galatians 2, to a letter written to multiple churches, and aired it all out right there. Now, was he doing that to diminish Peter's influence or Barnabas' influence with the brethren? That wasn't why he did it. Was he doing it to grind an axe against those men? No. It was a teachable moment, and that's why he did it. So are there times when it's justified to bring up someone's past sins against you or against someone else? Yes, it is. But I don't think, based on Proverbs 10 and verse 12, that that should be our default setting. We should exercise prudence when we do that. And we need to always think about what our intentions are when we do it and the effect that it's going to have on another person. Why should we care about this? Does this proverb essentially boil down to the way in which I judge and assess others? I think it does. It speaks to what I'm going to let fester in my heart, this hatred, or rather, what I'm going to nurture in its place, a love that covers over transgressions that another person has repented of. Does that matter? I think it does. Let's keep our marker in the book of Proverbs, and this time let's go to the New Testament, to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 14. Just after Jesus modeled prayer for his disciples in the Sermon on the Mount, he said in verse 14, "If you forgive others for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you." So if I'm a person who is looking to act out of a sense of love, out of what is best for other people, and if I'm keeping the wisdom of this proverb in my mind, which I should, because as we'll see in a moment, it shows up again in our New Testament, then that means that when I forgive other people, I'm also going to, in some sense, forget about what was done. I'm not going to harp on it to that other person and keep dredging it up over and over. Why do I care? Because of verse 15. If you do not forgive others, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. So it comes down to, how do I want to be judged when I stand before the Lord? Do I want him to harp on things I've done? Do I want him to judge me with bitterness and spite within his heart? Or if I have genuinely repented, do I want him to forgive and to forget? We all know the answer. In Matthew 7 and verse 2, speaking of the standard of judgment, Jesus said, in the way you judge, you will be judged. That doesn't mean that you cannot judge your brethren. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't. This is the same man who said, judge with righteous judgment. And yes, that means sometimes you're going to open up the past like Paul did in Galatians 2. But just remember that the standard by which you judge others is going to be applied to you. He said, your standard of measure will be measured to you. So does it matter if I'm following the wisdom of Proverbs 10 and verse 12? Well, you tell me. How do you want to meet God in the end? If your judgment matters to you, then the wisdom of the proverb will likewise matter. I think we understand its importance then. Now, for the rest of our time, let's talk about what it looks like in action. The Bible has a lot to say about that too. I'm going to go back to the book of Proverbs, but this time I'm going to look in chapter 17 and verse 9. Chapter 17 and verse 9. You're not going to find the exact same wording here, but it is the exact same principle. Proverbs 17 and verse 9. The New American Standard Bible says that he who conceals a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. The first proverb that we looked at was about the character of love and hate and the kind of actions that are characteristic to them. This proverb is about the fallout that comes with making the wrong choice. This is about the damage that is wreaked when you decide to act out of hatred, or the blessings that you can reap when you decide to act out of love. If you have the old American Standard Version, probably nobody in here does, harpeth that he that covereth a transgression seeketh love, but he that harpeth on a matter. There's that word earlier for a reason, because it's in that translation. I think we understand the idea in harping on something. Christian says intimate friends. American Standard says chief friends. Even the best of friends can have their fellowship wrecked because of failing to abide by God's wisdom. The NIV says that whoever would want to foster love covers an offense. What choices am I interested in making? Do I want to foster and nurture love? Then I'm going to have to do some forgiving and forgetting in my life. But whoever repeats the matter separates close friends. And then finally, the NRSV says that one who forgives an affront. You ever been insulted by other people? You ever been slandered by other people? You ever been slandered by your brethren, your spouse? One who forgives an affront fosters friendship, but one who dwells on disputes will alienate a friend. So where do you want to center your mind? Do you want to dwell on those things that will nurture and increase love, bonds of affection and unity? Or do you want to dwell on those things that will tear you and others apart? That's what God is speaking of in Proverbs 17 and verse 9. In verse 9, when he says that he who conceals a transgression seeks love, the idea of love is parallel to the idea of intimate friends. So love in this text isn't simply the idea of caring about other people. It's a special bond of affinity. And so what God is telling us is that a failure to forgive and put the matter to rest can divide even the best of friends, even the most intimate of companions, like husbands and wives. What's more intimate than that? Sometimes because they are so hurt and embittered toward each other, spouses will tell on each other. And they'll do it to their best friends, even their mutual friends. People who are friends with the husband and the wife. Sometimes they do it carelessly, not really giving any thought to what the fallout is going to be how it's going to affect their spouse when it inevitably gets back around to their spouse that they have said this. And they may not divorce, but their union is not going to be very good like God intended it to be in Genesis 1. They won't be happy. They won't be close. And how can you be when the person you're living with is constantly harping on your faults? Am I saying that there is no obligation on the other person in the marriage to change? I am not saying that. What I am saying is that there is an obligation on both people in the relationship to change and stop harping on the other person's shortcomings. There is an expectation from God's wisdom to put things to rest when they have been repented of. That is what the proverb is telling us. Should this matter to you? Well, again, I go back to Matthew 6 and verse 7, or Matthew 6 and Matthew 7. How do you want God to judge you? How do you want Him to handle all of your faults? Yes, even your secret sins, even the things that only people know about behind closed doors. Do you want all of your dirty laundry aired out to everybody? Now, you might be saying, no, I don't, but it's too late for me. My husband or my wife already took care of that for me. Well, that's unfortunate, and I'm sorry. But why did that happen? Did that happen because you were doing the same thing to him or to her? Because a failure to abide by this proverb seems to breed that exact same response in the other person. Do we not see that? Look in Proverbs 14 and verse 1. What I am saying from Proverbs 17 and verse 9 is be careful how you treat your family. Proverbs 14 and verse 1 says that a wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. I don't think that he has the bricks and mortar in mind, but rather the people who live in it. A wise woman builds her family, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. A woman who is always critical and spiteful and manipulative without being nurturing, without having consolation in her heart, she will tear down her family. Constantly nagging and berating people about things will tear down a home. Heed the wisdom and the warning of the proverb. Look in Colossians 3 and verse 21. Colossians 3 and verse 21. This text says, fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they will not lose heart. It may be that sometimes fathers only set expectations, as they ought to. In fact, that's one of the great failings of men in modern times. They become so emasculated that they do not set nor enforce expectations consistently. But it could be that children only hear expectations being set and enforced, and yet there is no positive reinforcement. There is no room for forgiveness. There is no room for trying to build someone up. And it's because of that, children may lose heart. He also says in verse 19, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Why would you be tempted to be embittered against them? Probably because she's not doing what it says to do in verse 18. Wives, be subject to your husbands, as is fitting in the Lord. So here's a husband trying to serve God. The wife doesn't submit to him as she ought to. There is a temptation for that to make a man bitter, right? What are you going to do? If you want to foster closeness, and if you wish to secure her loyalty and her trust so that she will voluntarily submit to you as she ought to, you need to remember the wisdom of Proverbs 17 and verse 9, further and further apart. Love covers transgressions. Love covers, as it says in other places, a multitude of sins. Is there no room for forgiveness, for forbearance, for patience, for kindness, for supportiveness? Can we not see the good in one another? Do you really want your spouse or your children to improve? Focus on first improving yourself. Remove the plank from your own eye. And then you may not be in any mood to go hunting for specks in your families. Love seeks to foster friendship and intimate bonds. It doesn't just forgive, it forbears, which leads us to the next reference I want to look at with you. That's in 1 Corinthians 13. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7. You're not going to find the exact same wording that we have in our proverb here, but again, it's the same idea. When Paul wrote about the character of love, and in this case it is a caring love, a love that is willing to make personal sacrifices to serve the best interests of others, he said that this kind of love, in verse 7, bears all things. Now you may have a footnote on the word bears that will tell you another way to translate that into English is it covers all things. There's our word. Love covers all things. What things does he have in mind? He's not talking about just any and all thing. That does not mean that if somebody is breaking into your home to rob from you or to murder you, that you just have to forbear it. That's not in discussion here. He has a very specific situation in mind when he writes this. If you look back over in chapter 12 and verse 7, for example, he says that each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. And when he talks about the manifestation of the Spirit, that discussion goes back to what he mentioned in verse 4 and following. At this time, there were people in churches that had miraculous gifts. And you know some of the ones listed in this very letter to these people. Some of them could heal people. Some of them could prophesy. They could reveal God's word from their own mouth. Some of them could speak in languages that they did not know. And others could, in fact, interpret those same languages into a tongue that everybody else can understand. And when he tells them this in chapter 12 and verse 7, that everybody has been given one of these talents for the common good, he has to say that because they haven't been exercising them for the common good. Further down in the same chapter, he talks about the imagery of the body. And he says in verse 21 that the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Or again, the head to the feet, I have no need of you. Why would he be making that point? Obviously, a body part literally doesn't say that. But this is the foolishness that is evident in the way that some of these brethren are conducting themselves. Because he said in chapter 14, still talking about the exact same thing, he said in chapter 14 at the end of verse 26 that whatever it is, whether you have a tongue, a revelation, or an interpretation, everything should be done for edification. That means everything should be done in a church assembly with these gifts for the building up of other people. The problem was that many of the people here were not using their gifts with that aim in mind. And that's why from verse 27 down to about verse 33, he has to tell tongue speakers that if nobody can understand you, they can't be edified by you. So if you want to stand up in an assembly and just showboat and use your gift without an interpreter, you need to sit down and shut up. Because you're not thinking about what's best for others. So when he says in chapter 13 and verse 7 that love bears all things or covers all things, he is talking about having to put up with some things from God's people. Because sometimes when you work with God's people, they are going to disappoint you and let you down because they are not always mature. When you read the letter to the Corinthians, you see all kinds of problems. You see one man at least who was living in open rebellion and defiance of God's will. And Paul told the brethren there, you need to socially cut this man off. Now that's helpful for us because when we see that love bears all things, and I think rather the idea is especially love forbears all things, it does not mean that there is never an end to your forbearance. Nobody should take anything I'm saying this morning to mean that. Sometimes, yes, there is an end to your forbearance, and there must be if you're going to love the other person like you ought to. But many times, there's just simply no bearance at all. And that is not what God expects of us. The fact is that God's people are going to let us down. So what do we do in those cases? Paul had a choice. He could have, after he spent a year and a half of his life among these people, teaching them with his life in danger, after hearing about the problems there, he could have just said, I'm done with it. I'm not going to try to help these people. I don't have the energy for it. Instead, he sat down and he wrote a letter to try to bring them along where they needed to be. What would we do? We're blessed that we don't have the problems that were evident at Corinth here. But what if we did have those problems? What would we do? Just turn tail and run? Or try to work through them to help people get where they need to be? He says that love bears or covers all things. What does that look like? We'll look back in verse 5. Love does not act unbecomingly. What if you had gone to church at Corinth, though, one Sunday morning and the song leader got up and it's just obvious that he's an arrogant jerk? He's in it for himself. He's in it for his own self-aggrandizement, flattering and stroking his ego. How could you handle that guy? I know what my instinct would be, because I can be snarky, right? My instinct would be to act unbecomingly. But Paul said that love does not seek its own and is not provoked. Like, it's not provoked to inflict something on somebody else because they first inflicted something on you. Love does better than that. Love seeks to treat people the way that is going to help them get where they need to be, even when they don't deserve it. He also said in verse 5 that love does not take into account a wrong suffered. That sounds an awful lot like that last proverb we just read. But what do we do when we deal with people? Do we keep a little ledger book? And it's got all the slights that we've ever suffered in there, be they real or imagined. And we've got the column of credits and debits, black and red. Because when he says that love doesn't take into account a wrong suffered, that's the idea. You throw that book away and stop keeping a record of every wrong that you've ever suffered at the hands of others. These people that were at Corinth, they would have been a frustrating, discouraging group to work with. I'm glad that I was not a member of that church. But if I were, I'd have had to have loved them. I would have had to have persevered in treating them the way that they ought to be treated so that they would one day act the way that they should act. And I think one thing we should keep in mind that would help us to cover all these things when we deal with people, to forbear with them, is that there's a difference between people who live in open rebellion and others who just have glaring blind spots, who are simply not mature enough yet to see where they're failing God and failing other people. But at bottom, their heart is still turned toward trying to serve the Lord. There's a difference between those two groups. They're just immature. So what do we do when we're faced with them? Whether we want to admit it or not, when we became a Christian and when we joined this local church, we promised to work with people even when they're not easy to work with. That's what we signed up for. We promised to help people even when we occasionally get hurt in the process. Paul said that he was hurt by these people in the second letter to them. He talked about the tears that he cried over their situation. And yet, he sought to serve their best interests. Love bears all these things the same way that Christ's love bears all of his disappointments and frustrations with us. And that leads us to the next reference I'm going to look at with you. And that's in 1 Peter 4. Look in 1 Peter 4. And verse 8. Peter said, "Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins." There's our proverb, and this time the language is pretty similar to what Solomon first wrote in Proverbs 10 and verse 12. What does he have in mind? I'm just going to keep reading. I already know from verse 8 that whatever's going on here, the application is geared specifically toward the way that Christians treat one another. That's clear. He says in verse 9 to be hospitable to one another without complaint. Now, I don't think he's only got his thoughts in verse 8 I don't think they're only meant to be applied to hospitality, but that's where I'm going to look for now. Because verse 9 is interesting. Be hospitable to one another. He just talked about keeping fervent in your love for one another. And he said to do that because love covers a multitude of sins. But whose sins are in view this time? Is it the sins that other people have committed, maybe against me or against others? Or is it my own? Because in verse 9 he said, I need to be hospitable to one another without complaint. Is there ever any reason to complain in practicing hospitality? Sure. Sure there is. In fact, I've heard people do it. Nobody ever invites me over or takes me out. People say that. I'll do it if other people would. People say that. People say, nobody ever takes me up on my offer to open my home or to go out. And I'm not saying that there is no truth in what people say when they say those things. I get it. But the question is whether or not we're going to let that be an excuse not to do the thing that Peter says to do in verse 9. Are we going to make an excuse, or are we going to love other people? Because that's the choice that is before us. We can either let hatred stir up strife over transgressions. We can become embittered and angry and cynical about other people and their failings, and just let that be an excuse to wall ourselves off from engaging with other people and serving them. Or we can do what Peter said to do. We can always find an excuse not to serve, especially when it comes to our brethren. They will always give you an excuse if you want one, no doubt. But what about with the Lord? Can we always find a motivation to serve even when the brethren are tempted to give us an excuse? That's what Peter goes on to say in verse 10. He said, as each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. What do you mean? Whoever speaks is to do so as one who is speaking the utterances of God. Whoever serves is to do so as one who is serving by the strength which God supplies. So I could let myself be a hermit with God's people if I wanted to, because of the way they might receive my offers, or maybe because they don't seem all that open in getting to know me in the first place. I could do that. But Peter says, you're not serving on the basis of the strength that your brethren give you. It's on the basis of the strength that the Lord gives you. And why am I doing that? So that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory and dominion forever and ever. I could think about maybe instead of how much complaining I could do about my brethren, instead of that, I could be thinking about the fact that when God sent his Son into the world, rather than receive his offer to take him in, they slandered him and beat him and murdered him. And yet, knowing that that was going to happen, he did not let that stop him from carrying out his plan anyway. He decided to just go ahead and love us, even when we didn't deserve it. He decided to just go ahead and let his Son die and raise him up from the dead, knowing that there would still be people even after that who would not bow their knees and worship, who would still defy him, who would still curse his name, and then they would persecute the people who decided to receive him for who he really was. He knew all of that was going to play out, and yet he still said, I'm just going to love you. I'm going to do what's right by you. So when he says back in verse 8, keep fervent in your love for one another because love covers a multitude of sins. I'm wondering if the sins he has in mind are not so much the sins of my brethren, but my own. Because he said to be hospitable to one another without complaint. Maybe if I'm just busy loving and serving other people, it's going to take my mind off of everything I have to complain about. And maybe that's better for my soul's sake and the sake of others than letting my bitterness fester in my heart. The last thing I want to look at with you briefly is found in James 5. verses 19 and 20. My brethren, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. I wonder if I think about that like I ought to. Because the fact is that I've known people who have left the Lord. And I think that their soul right now is in the jaws of death. I don't know how many of those people I've actually made an effort to reach out to in the course of my lifetime. Some of them I know I did. But if I'm interested in covering a multitude of sins, then that would say something about how much love is within me, right? So I guess the question from verses 19 and 20 is, how much do I love the lost, even when the lost already know better? Does that mean that there is no obligation to do what Paul said to do in 1 Corinthians 5? Obviously not. But how many people that have turned their back on the Lord have I loved enough to try to save from their newfound death? The promise here is profound. Even if you've known Jesus and confessed him and then you turn your back on him, if you repent, he is willing to forgive you. It's what he wants more than anything else. It's why he came to this world. It's why he died. Because he wants to pave a way for forgiveness. I could let myself act on love. Or maybe, going back to what Solomon said in Proverbs 10 and verse 12, maybe I could let hatred stir up strife over this person's transgressions. Maybe I could let myself say, why can't you just do as you're told? Why can't you just act right? Why do you have to be so expensive to my energy resources to try to work with you and save you? I mean, those are the options, I guess, if I'm sticking with Proverbs 10 and verse 12. So where are you this morning? Do you meditate on the fact that Christ's love for us has covered a multitude of our sins? That as long as we are penitent, he is not going to just stand there and constantly complain about us and harp on our faults and dredge up things that we have prayed for and asked him to put to rest? And do we let his love for us motivate us and renew us to a sense of purpose to serve his people, to improve our closest of relationships, for those of you that have a spouse, or to rededicate ourselves to the service of his people? Because that is the power of his love for us. And if we choose to act on it, then we will do the very thing that Solomon said. We remember that hatred stirs up strife over transgressions, but love will forgive and forget them. Love will forbear them, even when we're working with people who, though penitent, still try our patience. That is the power of Christ's love. If you need help being restored to life within Jesus Christ, maybe because you are the person of James 5, 19 and 20 this morning, then we stand ready to help you. Or if you're someone who has never known the life that is in Christ and in him alone, we stand ready to help you. Let us know how we can assist you as we stand and sing.